Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, TCT 2011, Interventional Hot Topics, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Stephen G. Worthley, MBBS, PhD, and Ian T. Meredith, MBBS, PhD. Dr. Worthley is a Helpman Chair of Cardiovascular Medicine, University of Adelaide, Director, Cardiac Catheterization and CMR, Cardiovascular Investigation Unit, Royal Adelaide Hospital, Adelaide, South Australia. Dr. Worthley has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Cardiovascular Systems, Biotronic, Medtronic, and St. Jude Medical. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Abbott Cardiovascular Systems and Medtronic. Dr. Worthley does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Worthley does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Meredith is a professor of cardiology and medicine, Monash University, director of Monash Heart, Monash Medical Center, Southern Health, Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Meredith has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abbott Laboratories, Boston Scientific, and Medtronic. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Abbott Laboratories, Boston Scientific, and Medtronic. Dr. Meredith does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Meredith does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to educate clinicians on recent data relating to current and novel interventional devices. This activity is supported by Daiichi Sankyo, Eli Lilly and Company, and Medtronic. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hi, I'm Stephen Worthley, the Helpman Chair of Cardiovascular Medicine at the University of Adelaide and the Director of the Cardiac Catheterization Laboratories at the Royal Adelaide Hospital in Australia. This discussion today is going to focus on some of the hot topics in interventional cardiology from TCT 2011 here in San Francisco. Please note that this will include some discussion of investigational devices not approved by the US Food and Drug Administration for use in the United States. I'm joined today by my good friend, compatriot, colleague, Professor Ian Meredith from Monash University, Director of Monash Heart and Monash Medical Centre in Melbourne. Let's start with the hot topic du jour, transcatheter aortic valve replacement. So Ian, what have we seen over the meeting to date, and more in particular the late breaking trials, that's helped advance our understanding about transcatheter aortic valve implantation?
Well, thanks, Steve, and thanks for having me along. I think it's been a really good meeting for understanding where we're going with transcatheter aortic valve replacement. We saw some interesting and, well, indeed very important results can come out. I think we now know that transcatheter valves are really here to stay, and we saw the great results from the PARTNERS B 2-year data set. Remember, PARTNERS B is the group of patients that have been randomised to either continued medical therapy or device therapy, transfemoral device therapy. And we saw at 2 years fascinating results, with almost double the number of patients alive, an additional year of survival in those treated with percutaneous valve, halving of the readmission rates. There was one statistic I mentioned to you before that I think is really fascinating, is that there were 150 admissions between year one and year two for those treated medically. And this is a relatively small surviving patient population versus 75 readmissions to hospital. And we also saw from the from the analyses of the partner data set that it indeed is a cost-effective strategy. And you may remember we also had data presented by David Cohen, and David looked at detail at the transfemoral and transapical data sets, looking at their quality of life and indeed cost effectiveness, or more, I should say Matt Reynolds looked at the cost effectiveness data, but we now know that transfemoral in high risk or surgically inoperable patients, transfemoral is cost effective, so it actually costs less than surgery and it improves quality of life, so you get quite a lot of return for your investment.
That rehospitalization data is interesting from the Partner B you mentioned, Ian, because I think in those patients still alive in the Partner B cohort that were treated medically, 75% of them had actually been rehospitalized in the first 2 years.
Yeah, that's right. Health payers, they've got to take a good look at this, and for regulatory agencies and for governments and other institutions that are paying for the healthcare costs, it clearly shows that there is an advantage to treating those that would have otherwise languished on medical therapy with a percutaneous valve, if indeed the patient is suitable to a transfemoral approach.
Yes. What was your take on some of the issues that we saw around the transapical approach? I think we had some quality of life data that was interesting from Dave Cohen about the transapical, and then, of course, your thoughts about the Staccato trial.
Yeah, so, look, it was a little sobering. I think it's probably too early to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it was certainly very sobering data sets, wasn't it? I was impressed by David's analysis looking at quality of life in transfemoral and transapical cases, and the quality of life was not improved over the surgical arm of those patients, at least early on. It sort of leveled up a little bit by 12 months, but there was no quality of life advantage for transapical over a surgical approach in the high-risk elderly patients, at least in the short term. And more importantly, it actually cost more to do the transapical intervention than the surgical intervention. But in defence of the transapical, we have to say that this was an early trial and that there wasn't a great deal of learning prior to the trial. In fact, most of the learning curve was absorbed into the study. And indeed, the patients that were in the transapical arm were not randomised patients. They were patients that were, if you like, relegated or into the transapical arm because they weren't suitable for the transfemoral arm. And that really was a marker of a higher level of overall comorbidities. But again, disappointing, and when you add this to the stroke data, it does suggest that transapical might in the future be more of a niche approach to percutaneous valve replacement.
Yes. And it's this Staccato trial, of course, which was trying to look at transapical versus surgical, although in a slightly more intermediate risk group, and opening up the enrolment criteria to only over 70 years of age, I think, and as you know, terminated early. Ian, what do you think that means for this field?
Yeah, it's a puzzling study, that one, because it was done in Denmark, as you know, and they had had some prior transapical experience prior to actually enrolling patients. I think more than 40 transapical cases had been done before patients were enrolled into the study. But the guts of it was that it's transapical versus a surgical approach. And as you say, I think you're very generous to call them intermediate risk. Are they really in the low end? I mean, STS score of 3 and age above 70. I think the mean age turned out to be about 80 years of age, but still with STS score of around 3 in both arms, and certainly better results in the surgical arm. A couple of issues there. Maybe we're too early in the learning curve to do a randomised trial of transapical versus a surgical intervention, particularly in low-risk patients. One wonders with what we know from the other trials whether that would have been ethically appropriate to do that trial. But when you put all that data together, I think it's adding up that transapical might become more of a niche procedure for those that are not suitable to transfemoral or subclavian or indeed a direct aortic access.
I think there's some good points you raise. I think there's a lot of excitement and interest now, isn't there, emerging for some of these other approaches when the transfemoral access is not available. And we saw a great case, didn't we, from the UK, from Simon Redwood about direct aortic access earlier here at TCT.
Yeah, so I think there's an emerging body of data. We have to add a cautionary note about direct aortic access as well. There might be, we don't know what the potential risk of stroke would be from large bore cannulation of the aorta, although this is something that the surgeons do all the time, as cannulate the aorta as a part of their bypass procedure. So, but we do, the stroke issues still need to be resolved, I think, there.
Yes.
But overall, very interesting data, consistent body of evidence showing that percutaneous valves are indeed the treatment of choice in elderly patients, not suitable for a surgical intervention, and pretty good data when it is randomised against surgery for the transfemoral approach.
Yes. So, Ian, for you, the one or two take-home messages from TCT in the valve space, what would they be?
I think the things that I took away from this meeting was that valves show consistently good results between year and one, year two, with a increasing survival advantage between year one and two. Very, very reassuring data. No evidence from all the registry trials we saw of late valve failure, very low incidence of infective endocarditis. So looking at all of the global registries, the data looks very good. And of course, we saw some emergence of exciting new, if you like, second generation valve technologies that are going to deal with the repositionability, aortic regurgitation, and perhaps minimise vascular complications, stroke and bleeding.
Certainly we're all looking forward to that SADRA first in men experience, Ian, that you'll be leading in Down Under coming up in December.
Oh, you'll play a very important role in that.
Watch this space. Ian, I'm very interested to take a little tack on and move into a couple of topics that some are close to my heart. Radial artery versus femoral artery access.
Yes.
Rifle.
So I should be really asking you about that because you're very keen on this this topic. So I'm going to turn the question back on you, Steve, and say, tell me what you thought as a radial aficionado.
Well, look, as you know, Ian, I mean, Rival was one of those studies that perhaps had a little in it for everybody. Didn't meet its primary endpoint, although when you look at some of the sub-analyses, which are hypothesis generating.
Are you Rival or Rifle?
I beg your pardon, Rival, which is
Rival.
I think it's...
Are you going to do a Rival?
Because that's an important premise, I think, for what we've seen in Rifle.
Yep.
There was in the MI subgroup of Rival, there was a statistically significant reduction in major adverse events.
Yeah.
So I think many of us have come to appreciate that, look, not all bleeding is access driven. Probably around 60% if we consider major and minor bleeding is access related. And we've seen from Acuity, Horizons AMI, how important an event bleeding is in terms of its linked to cardiovascular events.
And hence the use of net clinical benefits as an outcome rather than just simply look at efficacy and ignore the complications.
Exactly. So a MACE event that includes bleeding as well. Look, Rifle, I think, was a very interesting study, and I think now really gives us two large pieces of evidence that make it pretty conclusive that radial artery access is the preferred access in ST elevation myocardial infarction. So in summary,
some of the stalwarts in the audience said, oh, I'm still not convinced, you know, it takes longer and you actually end up having to convert and you're wasting daughter balloon time. Do you want to deal with those issues?
Oh, I'm very happy to. So, almost a halving of cardiac death in Rifle purely from radial artery versus femoral artery access with an intention to treat analysis. But just to those questions, so it is true. We all understand that with radial artery access as your primary access, that is going to be an increased chance of conversion. So from the Rifle data, it was almost 5% of that group that were treated with radial artery access converted to femoral, versus only, I think it was 1.5% to 2% from femoral had to convert to radial, but some still.
Did we see that same sort of case volume relationship to conversion? So lower volume, lower uses of radial meant more conversion.
Yeah, good point. Look, you know, in fact, I've not seen that, not seen the data, so only having seen the abstracts, I don't think we tease it. But what I think was important, perhaps, for Rifle was it was only four centres.
Yeah.
So four experienced centres in, and only an Italian study. So my take on that is that probably a more experienced group of operators and institutions undertaking the study. Mm. Perhaps not surprisingly, we saw a statistically significant reduction in this net adverse event rate. But I think what was the take-home message for many of us was this reduction in cardiac death. 9.2% femoral, 5.2% radial.
So, it's stunning. What do you think, what's driving that? So, is it all bleeding?
Look, I think that there's a number of elements to that, but bleeding, I think, is an obvious core component to that. Bleeding obviously was less, and certainly the bleeding reduction was all access site driven. Not surprisingly, non-access site bleeding was no different between the two groups. And although, as you know, Ian, some, certainly a number of the major bleeding events are non-access site, we know that access site does account for more of the minor necessarily than the major bleeding events. Mm. It still is a determinant of that bleeding event. Now, it's hard to believe that that would account for all of that almost doubling in cardiac death. Mm. But
other variables? Were there other things? Were there any big differences between the patient populations or the way the two the patients were treated? As a
Look, on the superficial analysis that we've had so far with the abstract and the presentation, I can see no significant differences between the two data sets. And as I say, the purity of the analysis by being intention to treat, so not the actual treatment strategy that the patient got, preserves that as a as justifying that your upfront strategy in an experienced site is radial.
Mm.
So it's interesting, you know, although we saw a few people saying that when they had the show of hands, the A's had it.
Yeah, the A's had it. And it's interesting, it's so true in interventional cardiology how long it takes for things to actually be adopted because, of course, transradial angioplasty got going in the early 90s, but it's really only 15 to 18 years on that it's become so deeply embedded and ingrained in the treatment of patients with high-risk ACS and AMI. Good to be that, though.
But you raise a good point, which is that, you know, and I think perhaps chronic total occlusion intervention is suffering a little from this issue, which is that it's radial intervention has been a bit the sphere of the zealot. And so in the absence of good, well-controlled clinical data, you're not going to see necessarily a drive to mainstream.
That's right.
And now with the RIVAL trial, in particular the MI subset from it and from RIFLE, in the MI group, so now two studies, once we see this fully published, I absolutely see the shift.
Do you think then that future MI PCI trials should have radial artery angioplasty as the background to any other randomizations that might go on in the trial?
Yes, look, it depends on the question you're trying to answer. So if you're on antithrombotic therapy, then in fact you might not want radial artery access because in fact your events are going to be reduced. Mm. But Ian, but I would say as part of what is considered for the future gold standard management in acute infarct PCI, I'd argue strongly that radial intervention is that.
So the take-home message is that radial artery intervention in the setting of primary PCI leads to a mortality advantage? Do you think you're confident to say that? Or
so we've seen
it leading that way?
No, I don't know how many more studies we need. To be fair, this is not published yet, Ian. Yeah. So we want to see the full manuscript, understand all the nuances of it. Mm. But, you know, for me, two well-performed, large clinical randomized controlled trials.
Good stuff.
Sold. There's been some very exciting things in the drug-eluting stent space. Mm. Issues around biodegradable polymers. We've seen some great clinical data sets too. Mm. I'm interested in your thoughts about a couple of trials, but the first one I want to ask you about is one that you're the PI on, the EVOLVE trial.
Yes,
you
thanks,
must be
Steve.
Very excited about the results.
With the EVOLVE trial results. As you know, we have confirmable durable polymer DES, and there's always been a little nagging doubt about the long-term safety of confirmable durable polymers because of chronic inflammation. It's not to suggest that all polymers lead to an inflammatory response that might lead to increased incidence of late and very late stent thrombosis, and therefore the need for dual antiplatelet therapy to prevent that. So as a consequence of that that fear or that perception, we've moved into this era of looking at ways to reduce the polymer load and reduce the time which you're exposed to the polymer. And of course, at this meeting, we saw a whole host of different trials looking at different mechanisms, so either non-polymeric stent design, some fascinating trials, and also results with bioabsorbable polymers. Firstly, there was the 4 years of results of the LEADERS trial showing finally a separation in a statistically significant stents, separation in late stent thrombosis with the Biolumis AIM-9 on PLA.
Yes.
And Evolve, as you mentioned before, it was a great honour to present the Evolve trial. Of course, Evolve is the Synergy stent, and we looked at Synergy and Synergy half dose against the Promus Element stent. This is PLGA, abluminally directed, 3 to 5 micron thickness polymer, releasing everolimus in the same dose that we have everolimus on the Promus Zyant V and Platinum Element stent. We saw incredibly low late losses, so and consistent and non-inferior to the Promus Element stent. So Promus Element in this trial had a late loss of 0.15 plus or minus 0.34, and we saw 0.1 plus or minus 0.26 in the full dose arm, and 0.13 plus or minus 0.25 in the half dose arm. And of course, there were no differences in clinical events. So what that really showed us was proof of concept that you could actually deliver the same amount of drug and get the same, if you like, surrogate response in terms of late loss without having the polymer there for a long time. And of course, PLGA, three to five microns thick, gone in 4 months.
Very exciting results. A six-month angiographic endpoint.
Six-month angiographic endpoint. Yeah.
What's interesting, Ian, so with the four and a half dose having such strikingly good results, yeah, both of them numerically better, but of course non-inferior to the Promus, what does this mean for the program going forward?
Well, remember, it is a six-month late loss, yeah, and there might be a bit of late catch-up, and the patients really have only the patients studied in this trial have been relatively straightforward, classic first-in-man patients, so we wouldn't want to extrapolate this to diabetes, multivessel disease, long lesions. So I think it leaves the company with an embarrassment of riches in terms of whether they choose the half-dose or the full-dose therapy. But I think I'd caution going to the half-dose therapy until we see longer-term follow-up. We've got complete analysis of the IVUS data, and indeed we see some more complex lesion subsets. But another interesting one was the next trial. Did you see the next one?
No.
So next is a new stent that that has a well on the external surface of the stent, and it has no polymer at all. It just has an excipient to release sirolimus.
Like the drug-eluting balloons.
Same sort of principle, releasing it with an excipient out of a little well. And they showed, in a similar sort of design to what we did in Evolve, they showed a late loss of 0.14, plus or minus about 0.26 for all of the patients, and they showed that same sort of late loss even in their diabetic patients. And there were at least 40 diabetic patients in this small study. So
yes,
there was another example of a non-polymeric drug release with similar responses and with a similar clinical pattern and late losses best in class.
Yes.
And of course, earlier in the week, we saw several trials of different formats like that with abluminal bioabsorbable polymers or non-polymeric stents, all leading to a late loss in that sort of 0.12 to 0.15 range. So bodes well for the future, but of course, we've got to turn those into meaningful clinical studies and look at true clinical events and, of course, long-term safety.
Yeah, we're getting close on time, but there's two more things I would love to get your thoughts on. One in particular, the 20 study.
Ah, the 20 study. Yeah, I thought that was a fascinating study, and it's very much like the Resolute All-Comers trial. Probably in some ways it has strengths and weaknesses compared to the Resolute All-Comers trial. It's largely a single-centre study, but they did have an independent clinical event adjudication and independent core labs. Very meticulously done study. 1,300 patients randomised to the Zyant V or the Resolute stent, and it was truly all-comers. 85% of the people coming through the doors of the cath lab went into the trial. So very, very, very high rate of recruitment. They took everything. And what was interesting was that the target lesion failure, which is a primary endpoint, was absolutely superimposable for those two, and not too dissimilar to what we saw in the Resolute All-Comers trial, less than one full percentage point difference.
8.2 versus 8.3%, almost identical.
So in all ways, they looked superimposable, two very good stent platforms. The thing that I found most interesting was that the although not statistically significant, the definite and probable stent thrombosis in the first year had a reverse pattern compared to what we saw in the in the Resolute All-Comers trial. There were numerically more definite and probable stent thromboses early in the Everolimus arm.
1.1%
versus the Resolute arm, 0.86. And I think, you know, a great deal was made of that the first time around, and I think we often play too much on these things, which are indeed a play of chance, even in a large trial. And so we're seeing a reverse tendency in this trial, and I think what that really tells us is what we probably learned from Resolute at 2 years, that these are largely, Resolute All-Comers at 2 years, that they're very comparable in terms of their safety and efficacy in both straightforward and complex patients. So yes, very exciting results, really. Nice to see a trial like Resolute All-Comers confirmed in another study of the same magnitude. Yes. Gives you a great deal of faith that these two are very, very good and comparable products.
So the Resolute All-Comers concerns around stent thrombosis, play of chance, Ian?
I think it's a play of chance early, Ben. I think I believe that to be the case, because if you look at the 12-month and the 12-month to 2-year data, there was no significant signal with respect to the Biolinx polymer, and I think in this trial we've seen the reverse of early events occurring, and I think if we did another trial, it might be just back the other way or exactly the same. So these low frequency events, you only need a couple of those events, 1 versus 3 or 2 versus 5. People draw too much from that.
Very quickly, one last thing, renal artery denervation. It's been the hot topic for 2 years now. We haven't.
I should ask you about it. Let me ask you. You're, you know, very keen on renal artery denervation for the treatment of hypertension. Was there anything important for you?
There wasn't a lot here, but the Ulster trial was presented, a small study looking at treatment for an off study protocol group of patients, looking at hypertension reduction, confirming the reductions in blood pressure that we've seen in Simplicity 1 and 2. And interestingly, it was trying to look at also some other indices of insulin resistance, for example. Mm. Unfortunately, there was no difference in HbA1c's. But I think that right now, all of us are very interested in a number of studies that are about to emerge. Of course, Simplicity 3 has just begun underway in the US, I believe. Mm-hmm. So interesting, a sham operation, which the FDA has mandated. And of course, there's a plethora of new catheter designs that we're seeing emerge. And of course, we're very excited to be involved with the first in man Arsenal trial, the first multipolar catheter.
Do you think these second and third iteration catheters will actually have greater efficacy, or will it just be improved safety because of less need to manipulate the catheter once inside?
Good questions. In fact, improved efficacy, I think, is a long bow to draw. I mean, I think that's a very tough target to have, given the reductions that we've seen in blood pressure to date. Although, potentially, that may be what we're looking to achieve. I think that by having predefined geometrically perpendicular positions of your electrodes so that you can have great rigour around where your lesion creation is, will improve your denervation. Whether that leads to an improved outcome is hard to know. We'll wait for the data, but certainly I think the attraction is ease of the procedure, speed of performing the procedure, and although it's a relatively safe procedure, I think all of those will lead to improved outcomes.
So we'll probably have a long discussion on this topic in 12 months' time, do you think?
So we'll await a lot of the data that's going to emerge over the next 6 to 12 months in that space. So Ian, we've had a long discussion about a number of different things. We've gone from transcatheter aortic valves, We've gone to radial artery versus femoral artery access, drug-eluting stent platforms, and renal denervation at the end. For you, what were the two or three take-home messages that most stick with you from TCT this week?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, transcatheter aortic valves seem like they have very good long-term results, particularly from a transfer from femoral access, and I'd say they're here to stay. And we've seen all of the international registries showing very, very good results. The results are just improving all the time, so I think that's a solid technology and here to stay. And I think drug-eluting stents, I think what I've learned at this meeting is that there are consistently good results from the new designs with less polymer on them, and I hope that we can translate that into meaningful safety differences in the long term. I doubt we can improve on clinical efficacy. If we do, it'll be a very large trial to do that. But I think it we've got great promise to show improved safety in the long term.
Ian, exciting times in interventional cardiology.
Thanks.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Safe flight home.
As always. Thanks,
Jeez.
Steve. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity TCT 2011 Interventional Hot Topics. To participate in the CME Activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.